With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Knepper, and today I'll be talking to Adam Cribley about his new book, Kings of the Garden, The New York Knicks and Their City. Adam is a professor of history at Southeast Missouri State University. His last book was Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Adam, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, I loved your last book and thoroughly enjoyed this one as well.
Thank you.
I want to ask you is, you know, this time period that you covered, really, you know, the end of the dynasty up until the Ewing years is, I think, thought of by a lot of Knicks fans as kind of dark days in between two golden, as I call the kind of silver ages. And I think for a lot of people, that applies to the city as well, the city as a whole. So my first question is, what kind of drew you to this time in New York and New York Knicks history?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, my first basketball book was Tall Tales and Short Shorts. And that was intended to be kind of a breezy overview of the NBA in the 70s. And I didn't want to get too deep into a lot of social, political, cultural issues. But as I was doing the research for that, I ran across a line from a New York newspaper in 1979, in which Peter Vesey referred to the New York Knicks by using the N-word, the N-bockers. And so that got me, you know, got my brain spinning, because it was a period when I knew the Knicks were down, the Celtics were down. It was a period of transition in the league. And so I started to dig a little more into those Knicks teams, into the Celtics teams, and really latched onto those Celtics teams. They had some great personalities. There was a lot going on the team, but also I was drawn to what was going on in New York City at the time. One of my favorite baseball books is The Bronx is Burning by Jonathan Mailer. One of my favorite another favorite baseball book is Big Hair and Plastic Grass. And so those were books that I kind of saw an influence in what was going on culturally, socially, and then Mailer's book politically in New York City. And so started to do some digging at that point and really just became enamored with the story. What was going to maybe be a journal article turned into a book.
And what is the relationship between basketball and New York City?
It's inseparable. It goes back to, you know, the early Madison Square Garden days with Ned Irish, the NIT tournament, some amazing, you know, college basketball, CCNY in the 50s, 40s and 50s. But then it becomes even more important, I think, culturally, when we see the rise of playground basketball. And so playground basketball existed, but it becomes like a backbone of New York City culture in the 60s and in the 70s. And so by the time that my book kind of picks up in the mid 70s, there's a very clear playground basketball is an important part of the social fabric of New York City. The New York Knicks are an important part of the community of New Yorkers. And until the ABA comes in, the Knicks were it. They were the only show in town in pro basketball. And then in the college ranks, with the NIT still being the tournament through most of the 50s and into the 60s. That there was, at every level, basketball was intertwined with what it meant to be a New Yorker, or what was significant about New York City at the time.
Yeah, another thing I would add to that, I don't know if you ever read a book by Dan Gronfeld. Ernie Gronfeld's son wrote a very good book a couple years ago. I wish to God I could think of the name of it, but essentially it's about his family history is fascinating. His family's Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. And it's about kind of the role that basketball played in their rise from kind of being Holocaust survivors to the successful American family. And a major theme in that was that that basketball in New York City was a tremendous means of assimilation for immigrants, because it was, I think sports in general could play that role in this country. It's a way for you to belong and fit in. And basketball is the city game. So that was kind of a different facet to it that I just thought of as you were discussing.
Well, and that's a great point. So two things of that. The city game reminded me of the Pete Axtown book about playground basketball in New York City, but also that, you know, research just can never end. And so like I spent hours and hours researching, I've got, you know, hundreds of sources, and there's always one more that I'm like, oh, that'd have been fantastic. And now I'm going to, as soon as we get off the podcast, I'm going to check to see how I can get that book and read it, because Grunfeld's story is amazing. And one of my favorite things that as I was researching was I was able to talk to Hubie Brown. And in the early 80s, Ernie Grunfeld was what was a Hubie Brown type player. He was, you know, hard-nosed, hardworking, had come from this background of family being Holocaust survivors, came to the US, barely spoke English. A fascinating story. So yeah, as I said, it brings up the reminded about the city game, but also that the research never really ends. There's always more to find.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of start the book with really kind of with the 73-74 season. You know, of course the Knicks won in 73, but I think, and you kind of represented this way, 73-74 was really the end of the dynasty. You know, they were still very good. They made it to the conference finals, and then they lost three Hall of Fame players in the offseason. So what kind of happened after that 73-74 season?
Yeah, so two things. One is they lost the on-court talent, right? So they're trying to replace, for example, two Hall of Fame centers in Willis Reed and in Jerry Lucas with some unproven talent. This is in, and I try to remind readers, this is in the era before free agency. So it's not as if they could just open their checkbook and sign one of the potential free agent replacements. Instead, they had to kind of build from within and conduct some trades. And they just didn't have a lot of great young talent. And that happens when you have four or five really good seasons. They weren't able to replenish through the draft. And so, so on one hand, they lose talent. On the other hand, they lose that culture. The Knicks of the early 70s thrived on, you know, finding the open man, being unselfish, playing help defense. There was a lot of individual talent, but they all kind of, it sounds kind of corny, but they all kind of bought in. And so even fantastic one-on-one players like Earl Monroe gave up a little bit for the good of the team. And not that the players in 74-75 were selfish, but they didn't have that sense of camaraderie. They didn't always know where one another was going to be. And so they lost a lot of talent, and they kind of they shifted to some players who maybe weren't the sort of players they'd relied on for the championship teams in terms of buying in.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read about, you know, in your book, you do a great job of documenting the kind of reeked of desperation, but their attempts to replace those guys with big time talent, big names in, as you noted, in an era where you couldn't just go out and sign a high price free agent. So who are some of the guys that they went after to try and replace the great Willis Reed and Lucas and DeBuscher?
Sure. So the big target for the 70s and into the 80s was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So he was arguably the best player in the NBA between 1971 and 1980, maybe beyond that or whatever. But and he was a New York City guy, and he was not shy about his desire to get out of Milwaukee and go to a big city. And so the Knicks really thought they had a chance at acquiring him. He ends up going to Los Angeles and, of course, never leaves the Lakers. So that was one big target that they weren't able to land. They always had designs on, you know, finding or acquiring a guy like Bill Walton or, you know, kind of these elite NBA centers. And they never were really able to do so. They did get you know, a few years later, they were able to get Spencer Haywood and Bob McAdoo, both of whom I think are underrated in terms of looking at elite basketball players in the 70s. But they were not Willis Reed, and they weren't able, you know, to bring the team together like that. But yeah, so those were some of the names that they tried to acquire. You know, anybody that was an elite player, they, you know, not a center, but they thought that they could get David Thompson a few years later. And so it seemed like every big player who may be on the trade, the trading block or later the free agent market, the Knicks wanted a meeting at least.
Yeah. They were kind of stuck in that, you know, in the few years after the championship, they were kind of stuck in mediocrity. So they, cause you still had Frazier and Monroe there. So they were still decent and they weren't getting high draft picks. But you know, weren't good enough obviously to contend. What was the state of New York City at that time in the years, you know, as the championship, as the golden age, as you refer to it, kind of came to an end? What was going on in New York City?
Yeah, so it was the end of Mayor Lindsay's term in New York City, and he had kind of been he was the mayor that was there through the golden age of the Knicks. For better or worse, he continued to try to maintain these social programs that New York City had been known for decades, but the city was basically playing some accounting magic to just make the budget balance every year, even though they were actually getting farther and farther into debt. And once Mayor Beam comes into office, that all comes crashing down. And so the city is in economic shambles. They can't afford to maintain their social services that they had long been known for. They have to lay off teachers. They have to lay off cops. They have to lay off firemen. Those are obviously going to be very unpopular. And so not only is there a financial situation, a financial crisis, but there's also a crisis of confidence, right? There's this sense that things are bleak and dreary and terrible in New York City. When President Ford comes through, he tours the South Bronx, and New York City basically, you know, asks for a bailout. And Gerald Ford says no. That turns into the famous headline, Ford to City, drop dead. And there's this sense of like everything's terrible in the city. The Bronx is burning, right? I mentioned that book earlier. That's a paraphrase line from the World Series in 77, I believe. And at the same time, the Son of Sam killer is wreaking havoc in, you know, all five boroughs. It was a bleak time for a lot of people in New York City. And that on top of the racial issues that were prominent in the city at the time, in which you have African Americans moving into former ethnic neighborhoods that used to have Italians and Poles, now have African Americans moving in and Latin American immigrants coming in. So there's a lot going on in the city in the mid 70s, and it's not seen from those living it or from those without in a very positive light.
And it seems like the South Bronx was kind of the epicenter of that, of those struggles. Is that accurate?
Yeah, totally. And it, again, maybe a cliche, but it's like, you know, the phoenix that rose from the ashes, because literally the South Bronx is burning down. It was more economically sound for many property owners to just either burn the buildings themselves or allow the buildings to be burned down, because then they could collect insurance on a building that was, you know, decrepit or in a neighborhood in which no one was going to invest. And so, you know, literally hundreds of fires in the Bronx. And what of course that leads to is people that see that the city doesn't care about them, that people are out to, you know, to make money off their struggles. Again, predominantly African American and Latino communities. And so things were really tough. Life was really bad. And so that's really, as you said, the epicenter of it. And that allows then, of course, what comes next to emerge out of those ashes, that rubble.
And what comes next from a cultural standpoint? What comes out of that rubble?
Yeah, I was kind of setting you up there.
I appreciate it.
So it's hip hop. It's rap music. It's the other thing that drew me to this era of history in New York City. I mentioned this in the preface and stuff, but you know, I grew up a white kid in the suburbs of Ohio, and so for me, I didn't experience the things that these early hip hop artists are going through, but the music was so like intoxicating, and I've really gotten kind of into early hip hop. And so what happens is you have these young, again, mostly men, not entirely, mostly African American, but not entirely, that begin kind of exploring new musical styles. And they have records, they have turntables, and so they start switching songs, they start speeding up songs, they start, spinning records, and eventually they start speaking lyrics over breaks in the music in which there's no, the drum line or whatever carries the beat, and people start dancing to that. People start like, we would later call it rapping or freestyle rapping, but they begin speaking to the beat over that music, and this grows up in the South Bronx, and by the early 80s has become a national phenomenon. So the fact that this musical genre doesn't exist arguably in 1972, but is international by 1982 is fascinating. And that it comes from the South Bronx, where this social dislocation, this economic disinvestment emerges, is really, to me, another fascinating part of this story.
Did the trying to think of how to express this. Did the social and cultural, I'm sorry, did the social and economic struggles of that time, was that necessary for the birth of that art form?
I would argue yes, because at one point, at one major element of this was that hip hop, break dancing groups, they would have called themselves B-boys, B-girls, that in many cases became an alternative to violent gang lifestyles. And so the violent gang lifestyles are kind of overrun much of the youth culture in the South Bronx before this. And it gives them a creative, artistic outlet. When you couple, rapping, hip hop dancing, graffiti art, it becomes a different expression, a different way to express those same social and economic frustrations. So you don't want to be part of a gang, you don't want to fight, you don't want to be part of that gang culture, but you still need to feel part of something because life is pretty crappy. This is another outlet, right? You can listen to music, you can dance, you can spray paint your art on subway cars. And so, yeah, I do think that in many ways, the way that it emerged could only exist in an environment that was so difficult socially, culturally, and economically.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
And while this is going on back on the basketball side, you talked about some of the big names that the Knicks added, I guess Haywood and McAdoo being the biggest, that didn't pan out. And then, like the end of the decade, the end of the '70s, they kind of shifted gears again. They unloaded both of those guys and brought in, some talented young players. How did they kind of shift course and where did they go from there?
Yeah, so the management of the Knicks decided by 78, 1978, this isn't working. We need to, 77 maybe, but we need to get younger. We need to not try to cling to the glory days. So Walt Frazier ends up going to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Haywood and McAdoo are both traded away. And Earl Monroe kind of becomes a fringe piece and is gone by the early 80s. And so they decide to reinvest in what had been kind of ignored earlier, which was the NBA draft. And so they got younger. They have, by 1979, they've got a core of young, exciting players. My favorite among them to read about and to watch was a guy named Michael Ray Richardson, who is an athletic guard. A wing. He's 6'5", 6'6". He was one of the most exciting players in the league. He leads the league in assists and steals one season. He regularly threatens a triple double. getting points and rebounds in addition to the assists and steals. And so he would have been, I mean, he would be a social media sensation in 2024. And so he was one of the guys that they kind of build around, but they do become a younger, more athletic, a more exciting team. And yeah, that's when, of course, in 1979, they become the league's first all-black NBA team. And, you know, to go back to what we started with, like, that's the team that really got me excited and interested in this period in Knicks history.
And what was the reaction to that all-black team, you know, both among fans, New York fans, the media, owners, executives around the league? What was the reaction to that?
You know, it was really mixed. Which I guess doesn't surprise me, but there were very few people who publicly said that this is a bad thing for the NBA, right? Obviously, Peter Vesey's columns notwithstanding, most of the negative opinions of it trended in the direction of we don't know how this is going to work out. And will white fans come and see black players? It's one thing to, you know, to have all black players on the court at the same time. It's another if there's no white faces even on the bench. That, again, many white fans would root for, that the end of the bench guy get in the game. And this is, again, something we see in 2024. But there was certainly a racial dynamic in the 70s that doesn't exist as much today, where it's... you know, so there were negative opinions. There were also some very positive opinions that said this is great for the league. Like Walt Frazier had long said he when he came in the league, there was kind of a quota system that you could have about 60% black players on your team, but the other 40 needed to be white. So for players like that had kind of felt held down because there was a perceived need to have white players, they were very positive. I would say most people that commented on it at the time, whether they believe this or not, claim colorblindness. Like, we just want the 12 best players on the court, whether they're to quote Sonny Werblin, who was essentially the owner at the time, we don't care whether they're white, black, red, or green, we're going to get the best 12 players. So I would say most of the reaction publicly was that, but there was also an undercurrent of people who were at least concerned, if not upset, that the Knicks fielded an all-black team.
And how did it go for that all-black team?
Well, the first season was great. 79-80, they had their most, you know, the most success that they'd had in several seasons, and they're exciting. The one kind of, I guess, red flag at the time was attendance. And so Madison Square Garden had regularly sold out during the golden era of the early 70s. And even by the mid 70s, they were still leading the league in attendance, even if they weren't selling out. By the late 70s, their attendance drops, you know, for the first time in more than a decade, to below 10,000 a game. And then you start to get reports that, well, they said 6,500 showed up, but we think they're cooking the books a little bit. So that was the one kind of red flag was, yeah, they're having great on-court success, but nobody's coming to the game. And so 1980-81, they had, again, an all-black team. Again, they had a successful season, but there was a perception that they were missing something, that this team needed a veteran presence or needed something. And so they make some deals at the end of 81, and this brief window of like them looking really good closes.
And they bring in a fiery coach who a lot of people know from still going strong at age 90 on the broadcast. Talk about Hubie Brown a little bit. What was his background? What kind of coach was he when they brought him in 82, I believe?
Right. Yeah. So Hubie, and I'll just throw in that I was able to interview Hubie about 2 years ago for this book project, and he couldn't have been sharper. I mean, he still remembered things that I verified through, you know, primary sources, but he still remembered things that had happened at that point, you know, 35 years earlier when he coached the Knicks. So Hubie had a background. He started, as most did at the time, as a college coach. He had some success. He went to the ABA. He had some success. he went and then coached the Atlanta Hawks for several seasons, and he turned around. You know, they were one of the lowest salaried teams in the league, and he built them into this, you know, Disney movie-esque group of fiery underdogs, scrappy underdogs. And that was like his perfect kind of team. He really wanted thrived in an environment where there was no superstar, that everybody had to pull together. Everybody had to give 110%. That was the kind of team Hubie wanted. And so he comes to New York from Atlanta in 82. And the Knicks roster isn't necessarily made up of a lot of those blue collar, hardworking, grinded out types. And so he works to rebuild the roster to maybe more suit his image. And that, you know, soon after he arrives, Michael Ray Richardson is gone. And so they move on from really the rest of that team that had shown that excitement in 79.
Yeah, you know, the blue collar things, the blue collar guys are great, right? I mean, everybody loves them. That the Knicks right now are thriving on a blue collar roster. But you know what? You need blue collar only takes you so far. The Knicks are the number two seed in the Eastern Conference in large part because Jalen Brunson's averaging 29 points a game. And the Hubie Brown put together a roster of scrappy guys, but perhaps most importantly, he acquired the King of New York. And so talk a little bit about, I'm a little too young for Bernard, but the old heads from New York, when I was growing up, like, man, Bernard King, they would talk about him in these, you know, glorified terms. Talk a little bit about Bernard and how good he was at that time.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, similar situation. The Bernard King I remember was Washington Bullets post knee injury, which he still was an outstanding player. But similarly, yeah, I've talked to plenty of old heads who, oh, Bernard in the garden, right? Like there was a mythic quality about Bernard. So Bernard King had an interesting path to the Knicks. He was a New York City schoolboy legend, went to the University of Tennessee, became a national phenomenon as part of, you know, we mentioned Ernie Grunfeld earlier, the Bernie and Ernie show at Tennessee. And then he had a lot of issues transitioning to the NBA. Some on the court, many off the court, and some of those, you know, would follow him for years, but came to New York City, in fact, essentially in a trade for Michael Ray Richardson, and immediately captured New Yorkers. He was a superstar, and New Yorkers had wanted a superstar in that vein since Walt Frazier left, you know, 7 years earlier, and they hadn't had one really. McAdoo, Haywood were fantastic. Michael Ray Richardson, Bill Cartwright, fantastic, but Bernard was a different level. And Bernard was one of those players, and I heard this about him from so many people, that he would score a quiet 30. Right. So he would come out and at halftime, he'd say, oh, Bernard, he was kind of quiet in the first half. He, you know, played well, but you'd look at the box score and he had 16 points on, you know, 6 of 8 shooting and hit free throws. And he had the ability to take over games. He was relentless driving to the basket. He was, you know, strong. He was athletic. And he was just a scoring machine. And, when he was hot, you could go to him and, you know, 1, 2, 3 players defending him and it didn't matter. And so he had that, that alpha kind of, kind of mentality that the New Yorkers loved. And so when Hubie surrounded him with a number of players who would be that scrappy presence, it allowed Bernard to kind of take over at times, which Hubie, I mean, to his credit, he leaned into. And so he didn't try to, you know, restrict Bernard's ability to score, especially in big games. And, you know, that made Bernard really special.
And as the Knicks are, you know, have this kind of mini renaissance with Bernard, as you noted, you know, around this time, hip hop is really going mainstream. How did hip hop go from, how did we get from, you know, this creation in the South Bronx to as you noted, an international phenomenon. What was kind of the how did it break through?
Yeah, so it kind of follows on the heels of disco. So disco was it in New York City in the mid 70s to late 70s. And so there were clubs that popped up all over the city. And what hip hop engaged with were the kids who weren't old enough to get into those clubs yet, right? So by the time the late 70s comes around, they're old enough to get in those clubs, which means that the music that they're interested in, yes, some still like disco, but it's increasingly this new style coming out of the South Bronx. And so gradually some clubs uptown start to play disco. It starts to, you know, trickle into Brooklyn and Queens and other areas outside of where it's created. It's still very New York City based, even by the late 70s, but it starts to become commercially recognized with a song released in 1979 by the Sugar Hill Gang called Rapper's Delight. And Rapper's Delight I love it, even though, again, real hip hop says it's not authentic. It's enjoyable to me. But that becomes the first song really to get radio play. And all of a sudden now New York City radio stations are starting to play this song, Rapper's Delight, which is a musical genre that most people in New York City, let alone outside of the city, had never heard. And it gains popularity, it gains radio time across the nation. And soon you have then record labels trying to snatch up these other hip hop artists. And so they begin, you know, seeking out groups, they begin kind of creating groups. And these hip hop artists that had been playing for crowds in gymnasiums or on, you know, blacktop playgrounds outside in the summer are now getting record deals. So that's it spreads through clubs, but also once radio stations start to get a hold of it, then it becomes larger than just the South Bronx in New York City.
And how does it kind of penetrate NBA culture? Because, I mean, there's kind of common roots between hip hop and basketball. I think, you know, both kind of born and bred in the inner cities. But how did it become part of the NBA culture?
For the NBA players who played in the late 70s and early 80s, they hadn't grown up on that type of music, right? So the two ways that they engage that, one is a guy like Earl Monroe, who goes into production and begins producing songs by artists, and some of whom are hip hop artists. More common though was the route that Bob McAdoo and others took, which is they like going to the clubs, right? They like going to the disco, they like dancing, they like club culture. Once those clubs start to shift from disco to hip hop, they still want to do the clubs. And so they either gain an affinity for hip hop or, you know, they kind of move out of that stage of their life. What really happens though with hip hop in the NBA and why it becomes so integral is that by the mid 80s, you start to have players coming into the league who listen to hip hop, who were a teenager when the Sugar Hill Gang song came out, or when Grandmaster Flash releases The Message in 1982, like they remembered that. And I know that for me personally, and for many people, their favorite music is the music that they listened to when they were in junior high or high school, right? So if these guys are coming into the league now having grown up, for lack of a better term, listening to hip hop and rap, that becomes an important part of their culture. And as you said, with the predominance of African-American players in the league, and that hip hop kind of grows mostly out of an African-American urban culture, it's a pretty clear link. And then, you know, kind of the last piece of that is the NBA makes a decision, somewhat conscious, somewhat not, to embrace that culture by the mid 80s and to lean into it a little bit and not to solely try to market their product for the white middle class, which had been most of the fans in the 70s, but instead to look at growing the game domestically and internationally, and recognize that hip hop was popular among youth. That was an important market that they wanted to capture. And so that's how it kind of goes from being a musical genre in which basketball exists to becoming really an important connection between the two.
And back to the Knicks around this time, we talked about Bernard a little bit, and he had this obviously incredible 83-84 season. And really in that postseason, he just turned into superhero. They beat the Pistons, Isaiah and the Pistons. They push Bird and the Celtics to the limit, and it looks like the Knicks are on the precipice of being, you know, a championship contender. And then it kind of all came crashing down. What happened there?
Yeah, so it's one of those, you know, what ifs, right? Like the team was fairly young. They were what you might call young veterans, and they had built through the draft some good role players, some players to play around Bernard. But then they really got hit with the injury bug. So the first thing that happened, kind of the first thing to occur, was that they lost their starting centers. They essentially had two centers that would play. Hubie Brown liked to play 10 guys every game to keep pressure defensively and up and down. Well, they lost their two centers. And so they had to move, you know, an undrafted rookie. I believe he was undrafted. Eddie Lee Wilkins, you know, becomes a center. He has a great game or two, and Knicks are excited that he's the next Bill Russell. And then, you know, obviously he isn't. They brought in a guy from Dallas, Pat Cummings, who was supposed to be kind of a forward. Well, injuries push him to becoming a center, and he was miscast as a center. And then the most, you know, the season was off the rails already. But then in March of 85, Bernard King blows out his knee, basically trying to chase down a fast break from behind. And at that point, the Knicks season was already going poorly. He'd already suffered some kind of minor injuries. But at that point, they tank. Whether intentional or not, but they certainly didn't have the kind of players that they could rely on to compete, even for a playoff spot. So 84-85, they do very poorly. What began as a season with championship hopes, or at least championship contention hopes, turns into posting one of the worst records in the league.
And of course, there was a big reward for them waiting at the end of that disastrous season. And 1985 was the first draft lottery. Prior to that, the NBA did a coin flip between the two worst teams. But as you know, the book, a lot of the Rockets teams were losing games intentionally to get into that coin flip and have a shot at the pick. So the league instituted this lottery. There were only seven teams in the lottery at that time, and of course the Knicks won that lottery. For those that don't know, can you explain the conspiracy theories around this lottery?
Sure. So the NBA was doing well, but there was a sense that the NBA would be better if there was a good team in New York City. And that with the Lakers dynasty on the West Coast and the Celtics on the East Coast, Chicago had a year earlier drafted a guy, you know, listeners may have heard of, named Michael Jordan. And so, like, if we could make the Knicks good, that'd be great. And there's a draft lottery, and when the name of the winning team is called the team that won the draft lottery, it's the New York Knicks. The second place team was the Indiana Pacers, who, let's be honest, league officials would have preferred that Patrick Ewing go to New York City, because again, the biggest market in the country, and what people thought would be the next mega superstar in the league was Ewing. Conspiracy theories abounded at the time, years later, and people have gone frame by frame to watch the televised draft lottery. And one conspiracy theory is that so the modern lottery uses like a ping pong ball kind of system. But then they had envelopes, like literally giant envelopes that had the team's logo inside. And you can watch in slow-mo, it looks like one of the envelopes is kind of banged against the side of this big giant like bingo hopper. And so some people said, well, they made sure to crease the corner of the Knicks envelope so that, you know, that wouldn't be picked until last. Other conspiracy theorists say that the envelope was thrown in a freezer so that it would be cold to the touch. And so the person drawing out the envelopes would know not to pull out the, uh, or So the way that they did it is they actually pulled out the winning envelope and kind of set it aside and then drew the rest until they got to the winning envelope, was that, you know, that way they would know which team had actually won the draft lottery. I believe that's how it was done. It's been a while since I've watched it. But regardless, there are these conspiracy theorists that say the Knicks were supposed to win the lottery. And even farther, the group that – so the NBA went to a third party to ensure that this was above board. And the law firm that they hired, one of the law firm's clients was also the Knicks. And so there was a, you know, conspiracy theories from many angles. Interviewed after, general managers, players across the league. Some of them said, yeah, it was clearly fixed. Others said, man, I don't think so. So, but even now, you know, 40 years later, and it's still a popular topic of conversation among NBA fans.
Yeah. And so this is 85 now, and the city's kind of come a long way from, you know, from Gerald Ford telling the city to drop dead. What is the state? We have Ed Koch now as the mayor. What is the state of New York City around this time?
Yeah, so Mayor Koch's administration is, on one hand, economically balance the budget, turn the city around, no longer on the brink of bankruptcy, does amazing things, you know, cleaning up the area around Times Square, which had been a kind of a dangerous, seedy part of town. Some, you know, reading plenty of books that said, oh, those were the good old days when you could go and watch a dirty movie and, you know, whatever down in Times Square. But we see Times Square cleaned up. We see a lot of social services reinstituted. Again, the economics of the city improve. But at the same time, there's still issues with race. You know, Koch had some issues with racial elements within his administration. At the same time, this is when we see New York City on the precipice of both a heroin crisis and also of an AIDS crisis. And Koch's, you know, hindsight's 2020. Obviously, they had never experienced anything like AIDS medically in the city. But, you know, his administration doesn't do a lot to fight against perceptions that, you know, AIDS is somehow retribution, punishment, whatever. So his administration, again, does a lot of great things, a lot of problematic things at that period. But in terms of economics, New York City is certainly in a better place by 85 than it was in 75. And in terms of being a safe place to visit, to live, it was clearly that. The South Bronx had been started, you know, there'd been some rehabilitation efforts there that didn't exist in the late 70s. Arsons, you know, dropped to basically, you know, normal by that period. And so it was a period of rejuvenation in which the Knicks then become the big deals in town. It's a period when, you know, the Yankees are kind of down, the Mets are good. You know, there's some good hockey being played in with the Islanders and Rangers, but the Knicks kind of take center stage again in this kind of rehabilitated, revitalized city that emerges by the mid 80s.
You know, it struck me reading your book that I think a lot of times when it comes to team building and we just overlook luck. You know, I think we ascribe certain general managers or presidents as geniuses, and we give credits to coaches and this and that, but a lot of times it's luck and it's picking the right guy. And I just going through your book, you know, like, the Knicks could have taken Larry Bird in 1978. They could have taken, you know, they passed on Clyde Drexler in 1983. And if they take either of those guys, it completely changes the trajectory of their franchise. If Bernard King doesn't blow out his knee, you know, as you noted, that's the big what if. I mean, if him, a healthy King and Ewing together, you know, that seems like a championship formula. I don't know, what do you think luck plays in franchise building and the success of a team?
Oh, 100%. And it's funny because as soon as you said the luck thing, I was just talking to some Knicks fans the other day that are still salty that you know, the Knicks didn't get Steph Curry back in the day, and that, like, right, again, butterfly wings, like, you know, if the Timberwolves took two point guards that year, and if they had taken Curry, again, just all the things that are different. You know, The Knicks certainly had that. You know, they could have taken Larry Bird, but then they don't get Michael Ray Richardson. You know, Bill Cartwright seemed like a franchise changer when he's drafted, ends up being a very, very good NBA player, but not, you know, not Magic Johnson, who was drafted in the draft ahead of him. But yeah, the what ifs, and obviously the, you know, Bernard blowing out his knees, a huge what if. He and Ewing never got to play together. He wanted to play with the Knicks again, but the Knicks decided that they didn't want to affect the development of Ewing. They wanted to build around Ewing. They didn't want to create a situation where a potential, they didn't know if Bernard could really come back from his injury and if he and Ewing would gel. And so they decided to cut Bernard loose, which was, you know, incredibly difficult for him. He ends up winning NBA Comeback Player of the Year with the Bullets, the Washington Bullets, a couple years later. But yeah, if he and Ewing had gotten to play together, Ewing, of course, like, is drafted to be the next Bill Russell, this dominant center that would have paired perfectly with a high scoring forward like Bernard King. As it turns out, of course, Ewing's a very good center, defensive center, but really offense kind of becomes his calling card, in part because of Gimpy Knees himself. But yeah, the what ifs there. And, you know, Ewing almost went to the Golden State Warriors a few years later when he becomes a free agent. So how do the Knicks teams of the 90s that you wrote about, how are those different if Ewing is playing with, you know, Tim Hardaway and Chris Mullin in Mitch Richmond in Golden State? And now there's no need for the Oakley Mason, you know, kind of sidekicks, for lack of a better term, that drive those 90s Knicks teams. So yeah, luck plays a huge role. And I'm going to believe that the 1985 lottery was not fixed and it was just luck smiling on the Knicks for once.
All right. Well, Adam, it was great talking to you about the book. I'll get you out of here with one final question I ask all my guests. But first, one more time, the name of Adam's book is Kings of the Garden, the New York Knicks in their city. Adam, my last question for you is, what is your all-time favorite sports book?
My all-time favorite sports book? You know, yours and mine notwithstanding, I would say that, you know, my favorite sports book is probably The Bronx is Burning. Jonathan Mailer, you know, basketball is my favorite sport, but Mailer's Bronx is Burning is just so good, how it engages both the sports, but also what's going on in the city at the time. And it was hugely influential on this book. So yeah, Mailer's Bronx is Burning is probably my favorite.
All right. Good choice. All right, Adam, thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with the book.
Thanks so much, Paul.